heart is aching. Smile even though it's breaking.
Who's that? You remember?
When there are clouds.
You don't. Sue Wells will know.
Are you saying Sue's old enough? Sue's old enough to remember.
No, I didn't say that. She's widely educated and she can tell us that the singer is Sue.
No, you've got me.
Nat King Cole.
Ah, oh, of course it is.
You knew that. This is the time of year when serenity should reign, but of course it doesn't. A lot of people are dead stressed. Many of us don't feel like smiling. But there is research that reckons you can smile your way into good humour. And so what do you think of this? Professor Fitz Strack and colleagues from the University of Mannheim, they asked volunteers to hold pens in their mouths.
You can
feel free to try this yourself now. I'll try talking with one in my mouth.
Okay, got it.
So you hold the pen in your mouth by the top of the pen.
Shall I just fill in what you do this?
Okay, then.
Like you're smoking. Is that what you mean?
Sort of, but with your either with your teeth or your lips. And so some were asked to hold the pen with their teeth, which produce a forced smile, like that, and others held the pens with their lips, producing a pout. And the volunteers were then asked to rate the funniness of Gary Larson's Far Side cartoons. And the cartoons were rated as funnier by the people with the pens in their teeth, the already grimacing ones. And so smiling, concludes Professor Strack and his team, can actually improve your mood, contrary to the usual belief that smiling simply reflects your mood. Are you convinced by this research?
This is from the department of what we already knew. This is obvious. It does. If you're not feeling too cheerful, if you smile, it will lift your mood. There is a very, very tight interaction there.
So even if it's a forced smile, that's what they've concluded, essentially.
Yeah. Yes. I'll vouch for this one.
Do you practice this?
Occasionally, yes. I realise it's like a complete crank on the air, but I'm used to that.
Okay, so you make yourself smile and you notice a mood lift.
Yes. You will feel it inside because it's a muscle memory that your body associates with happy times and happy feelings. You force the facial shape and your body remembers, oh, I do that when I'm happy. Oh, I guess I must be happy.
What do you think of the theory of Professor McCabe?
Oh, I'm just trying out my muscle memory for my happy time. It's got nothing to do with smiling. And it does actually work when you do that, yeah.
No,
I think there's but I look, I do have to challenge one thing. Now, Tyra Banks, you know her from America's Top Model.
Mm.
You don't, do you?
Yeah, no, I sort of do.
All right, well, she has a thing that she calls it a smize, S-M-I-Z-E, which is where, hang on, I'll take my glasses off, where one smiles with one's eyes. So instead of smiling with one's lips, you do this sort of duck face thing, but then your eyes smile. And that way you don't get the nasty, wrinkly crow's feet in the photos. You get fantastic cheekbones.
And do you have to say it in that voice as well?
Well, it helps.
Oh, okay.
But how do people know you're actually smiling with your eyes?
Oh, come on,
because you can see it. No, you can see it.
You can tell.
I mean, you know, if you get the blue steel. I know who does it. Colin Craig. That man can do a blue steel smize.
Okay. All right. Sometimes what if you've just got an unfortunate resting face, as many of us do, and people mistake you smiling with your eyes for some other kind of expression?
Like a squint. Yeah, bonus.
It is not always good to go around with a fixed rictus of a grin on your face. Researchers from the Universities of Illinois and California wondered whether professional fighters' smiles during the face-offs before bouts might predict the winners, and they got hold of face-off picks of 152 Ultimate Fighting Championships athletes, and the winning fighters were smiling less. And the conclusion, when you need to dominate, don't smile.
You can pick a fake one, though, can't you? I mean, if you look at wedding photos, there's always one.
People can fake their smiles quite well in this day and age, though, can't they? Don't you think?
There's something about that bit in there up around the top of your nose. You've got to get that right.
Yeah, the difference between a smile and just a faint grimace with your teeth bared, you can tell. And this business about the fighters, I mean, you know, just think of why anyone from, say, the All Blacks performing a haka at the start of a match to sumo wrestlers squaring off before they pile into each other. Everyone's known this for years. I mean, this again is research from the Department of the Screaming Obvious.
I'm sorry to bring you such old hat research, Mr. McCabe.
Come on, Maura, do better than this. Seriously, please.
And by the way, the Guardian newspaper says, if you're having a photograph taken, don't say cheese, say cheeks.
Cheeks.
Because cheeks will shape your mouth better than cheese will. And yeah. you'll look better saying cheeks, not cheese. Just a tip. See, you didn't know that. Now, Steve McCabe's on the panel. Sue Wells is too. Steve, you go first.
Okay, hold on, I'm going to say this while, with a smile on my face. It's Christmas time, and this is going to sound hideously cheesy and corny, but let's talk about what actually happens at Christmas. We've got the usual hideous orgy of consumerism, and yet what Christmas is actually about is happening over the road from here, outside the studios, over at the Auckland City Mission. There are people who are actually looking after their fellow human beings over there, and that is more what Christmas is about than who's got the biggest tree, who's got the best turkey, who's got the biggest presents under the tree. I think we forget what the original message of Christmas is, and I know that people are probably going to turn off their radios when they hear me use those words, because it's very unfashionable to talk about this. But look in the Bible, look in the Gospels, look at the actual story of the birth of Jesus, and what you have is a story of absolute poverty, absolute humility. We've got weakness, we've got vulnerability, we've got absolute dependence on other people and being looked after. That is what Christmas comes down to. It's not simply a huge consumerist orgy, which is what it's become in many Western countries, including New Zealand. I just thought we might need to remind ourselves of that.
But we don't have that same level of Christian commonality underpinning society now, do we?
Well, we have what is ostensibly a Christian festival at the end of the year.
Yes.
We're celebrating Christmas. So why not every now and then remember 2,000 years ago what the original point of the story was?
I was going to say he's making a fair point, Sue, but I mean, a lot of people just use it as a holiday time.
If you don't mind, segue into. Were you done, Steve?
I was just going to say that we have this holiday that people are celebrating. Just remember, you know, what the etymology of the word is. Even I mean, I know this is not particularly a practicingly Christian country anymore, but when you look over the road, like I say, over the Auckland City Mission, you see what they're doing. Certain people in this country are truly doing something very, very good.
All right, Sue.
I don't disagree with anything that you've said.
Excellent.
Now I'm going to tell you why I got into trouble for having a similar conversation to this, and I'm about to have it on this program also. Prior to Christmas, which is the Christian festival, there was a thing called Saturnalia, which was a pagan festival celebrated in midwinter to celebrate the winter solstice. And coincidentally, it's around about the same time of year, and there's been an awful lot of discussion around whether or not the Christmas festival has simply converged or words to that effect with that existing festival as one of the ways of taking out the pagan religion.
Almost certainly it has.
Yeah, well, so there we are. So all I can say is not everybody celebrates Christmas. Some people celebrate Xmas, which is what we do in our house. And that was exactly what I was going to talk to you about as well. For us, Xmas, which is always a festival at this time of year, has in the past been very, very stressful and very chaotic. And this year it's going to be low-key and lovely. We have no more than 14 people staying. Plus assorted thronging guests along to play Surly Secret Santa. But this year I've been inspired by two things that happened to me on one day back in, I think it was September. On one Saturday afternoon, we went to first a funeral and then a wedding. And it was Murray's funeral. Murray had died, been cremated, and Meg sent him off with fine fanfare at home. Small gathering, the people that that mattered. No celebrant, no fuss, no palaver, and it was just beautiful. It was elegant and simple, didn't cost a fortune. From there, we went straight to Nick and Rachel's wedding, which again featured Nick and Rachel doing it their way, their own vows, turning up together with the kids, beautiful dress that Rachel had made, flowers from down the road. It was lovely. It was simple. The heart was there in both of those cases. The decoration around it, the all of the drama was stripped back, and it became so much more poignant. For us, I think this year with our Christmas, what we're doing, we're not giving each other gifts at this time of year. We're doing this thing we call Surly Secret Santa.
Yeah.
Which was sort of, it takes the spirit of Christmas and then injects a note of reality into it by making it a combative game where somebody wins. Because, after all, isn't that what life really is about? In its purest, most distilled Darwinian form. So you have, on the one hand, the joy of Christmas, gift-wrapped, beautiful, and then you get particularly my mother involved, and she never loses this game. So you fight for your present under the tree. Instead of it being given to you nicely, they're all in the middle, and then one picks, and then you can take it off someone. And end of it, there's always a toddler crying, and my mother's won, and we have lots of whiskey, and it's a really good night.
Surly Secret Santa.
Fantastic. Absolutely brilliant.
Can I, on behalf of what Steve raised before, what is it about your Xmas, though, that makes you reach out to fellow human beings and embrace the poor like Christ did, if you take the Christ out and substitute the X? That's the point you're making.
I love the new Pope. Absolutely love the guy.
Thank you.
The Pope the other day was speaking... You're not the Pope. The Pope the other day
No, but I've been speaking up on his behalf for 2 years on the panel.
I just totally love him.
He's fantastic.
The guy speaks about... He spoke the other day about welcoming people who don't necessarily believe in the Christian religion and respecting their views and understanding that... I think... What did he say, Steve? Was it that more crimes have been committed in the name of religion? Words to that effect. And I thought, you got it, guy, you got it. Because being a decent human being and a spiritual human being is not, for me, in my mind, necessarily about ascribing to a particular religion or a religious platform.
Couldn't agree more. I do have to call you very quickly on one little thing. The X in Christmas stands for Christ. It is from the Greek letter
Chi, I know it does.
From the letter X.
No, it's not. It's the fact that I'm divorced. And so are lots of people. And these days you have to split your kids between yourself and your ex. Don't be silly, Steve.
I interpreted what you said what Sue said as her deliberately taking the Christ part out and putting an ex in for her own reasons, which is absolutely fine.
I have been duly chastised and corrected.
Okay.
Now, not yet.
It's quarter to five. Are you as sharp at 65 as you were at 55? Well, none of us knows yet, but would you say, judging by the older people you meet, that their brains are just as good? What's off the top of your head?
Depends on what profession we're talking about, doesn't it? I know where you're going with this.
Okay. Well, I mean, we have panellists, for example, in their 80s with very sharp brains. And we're about to consult an expert on this, but if anything diminishes by age 65, would you think it's what?
Well,
is it cognitive function? What is it? Reaction time?
I think it was the top part.
Right, so it's motor skills maybe down below. It's creaky joints and so on. There's been a groundbreaking ruling by the employment court allowing two New Zealand airline pilots to continue flying until the age of 65 for Cathay Pacific. Cathay Pacific senior captains David Brown, Glenn Sycamore have employment agreements that require them to retire at age 55. Mm. But they decided that was discrimination. An employment court judge has agreed and both men have won the fight to fly for another decade. It's slightly more complicated than that, but that's the gist of it. Is this good news?
Well, absolutely it is, because since 2006, the International Civil Aviation Organization have allowed pilots up to the age of 65 to operate international commercial flights. There is an international understanding that pilots are still demonstrably competent and assumed competent unless proven otherwise until the age of 65. It used to be 60, but like I say, since 2006... The understanding has been that pilots up to the age of 65 are assumed, unless they fail their medical exam, to be competent to fly even the biggest jumbo jets.
Okay, but as a pilot yourself, do you think that you'll be any less competent to pilot at age 65, as you, admittedly, you're a long way short of that now, but can you see that changing?
No, I can't. I have been on many flights. In fact, interestingly enough, I have recollections of getting onto a Cathay Pacific flight back to England many years ago and seeing a Cathay pilot, tall, strong, totally grey-haired. And he didn't look old, and he didn't look like he was going to be having a heart attack in the cockpit. I looked at him and thought, he's got my flight. I'm in good hands here. It inspires confidence. Whereas you see, you know, that with all due respect to them, the younger fellows, the ones who have, you know, just got out of flight school, flying the smaller flights around the country, thinking, do they actually know what they're doing? There's less confidence in those fellows.
I think if you're in your maturer years and you're flying solo somewhere and you're on IFR rather than VFR, then probably the chances of you splattering into something are greater than if you were younger, just mathematically, because, you know, age gets us all the time.
All right, let's... Okay.
In a Cathay Pacific plane, how many pilots would you have? Would you have two or three?
There'll be two pilots.
You'd have at least two. You'd also have your autopilot on most of the time.
True.
So the chances of both pilots having a catastrophic medical moment, I would say, are pretty low. And given that I think there's no requirement for a brain surgeon who operates without a co-pilot or an autopilot to retire at 55, I think it's a little bit draconian.
There may
that
be a requirement.
In the first place.
Yeah, there may be a requirement when flying a plane for reaction time in an emergency, wouldn't you think?
Well possibly. That's possibly
how much worse can that be than if you've got somebody's brain in your hand?
Well, that's true.
Well, you've only got one person's brain, not 500 people. So it's also worth bearing in mind that if you've got one flight crew member over the age of 60, the other one has to be below 60.
Thank you. Dr. Andrew Chancellor is a consultant neurologist with the Bay of Plenty District Health Board and is a past president as well of the Neurological Association of New Zealand. Joining us now on the panel. Andrew, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jim, and good Merry Christmas to you and Steve and Sue.
Oh, very good of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And good wishes back. Well, they're calling this a precedent-setting decision, Andrew, as well it may be. And is it a good precedent in your view? Can you give us your opinion on how well you're functioning at 65 up top compared to 55?
Well, this is a very interesting subject and controversial, but like other organ systems, you know, our muscles and joints don't work as well when we're on the wrong side of middle age. And like gas exchange in the lungs, I'm afraid to say that there are most definitely changes that take place in the brain as we age. It's not as agile, and cognitive performance does decline. And these changes can be related to imaging abnormalities. So, for example, if you test people very closely on multitasking, complex attentional function, processing speed, and indeed such things as remembering names or remembering the details of a novel, a movie or a painting. You were asking a moment ago, who was the singer Nat King Cole? That sort of thing is much more difficult as we get into late middle age.
All right, so a decline in cognitive performance. And you line that up against Steve McCabe's, you know, grey-haired pilot, Andrew, in whom he has confidence. Does that decline in cognitive performance matter when you're flying an aeroplane? Does experience counterbalance that? What would you think?
Well, exactly. We all know that highly rehearsed activities are slick and expertly performed. And the brains of 50-year-olds and 60-year-olds are certainly very much wiser. And there are some aspects of our abilities that probably do improve what we call social cognition, the ability to interpret the feelings of people around us. Decision-making may take a little longer, but it's terribly well informed by experience. And some aspects of language and some aspects of memory, such as knowledge of the world or words and understanding, are probably at their best. So I think I would agree with Steve that despite these higher order capacity changes, the effects of performing a highly practiced routine and experience count for so much more. And I think I haven't read all the details of the decision, but it sounds very appropriate that 55-year-old pilots continue to work if their health is good.
Can I ask you, at what age wouldn't you employ someone as the pilot of a big plane, out of interest?
Well, I don't think there is a clear cut-off. Clearly, some people... this question of whether cognitive decline in dementia is a sine qua non of ageing, you know, if we all live long enough, will we become demented or not? I mean, that word is rather pejorative and being used rather less now. But I think there's no... For some individuals who are very fortunate, cognitive function does not decline well into old age. So there shouldn't be a strict cut-off. And it should be based on individual profile and skills and ability to perform your job well.
And I would like to mention at this point that all airline pilots are going in for first-class medicals every 6 months. So
yes, well, in fact, I examined a pilot today, not because of cognitive difficulties, but pilots do have extremely stringent medical requirements, much more so than than doctors or the neurosurgeon you were referring to before, and impaired doctors are probably more of a problem than impaired pilots.
That's interesting you say that.
And pilots also undergo six-monthly simulator checks as well. This is a very scrutinised and very regulated profession. I think that, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but most signs of ageing such that they would impair your judgement as a pilot aren't going to show up within 6 months.
No, much longer than that, yeah.
All right, thank you, Andrew. Dr. Andrew Chancellor, consultant neurologist on the business of flying an airplane when you're 65, which these two gentlemen can now do with no loss of pay because they were offered the opportunity to transfer it to a new employment agreement, which would have seen them paid at a lower pay scale but be allowed to still fly, but they didn't want that, and Cathay Pacific disappointed with the decision. Now, what else can we talk about now? I might ask you, Sue, about Tony Abbott. Outrage after he says women are focused on the household budget.
Oh, look, I think everyone's being just a little bit unfair on poor dear Tony. Bless him. Hashtag thanks, Tony. He's just doing right by women. I mean, what is he, Minister of Women's Affairs?
He is the Minister for Women.
Oh, look,
in Australia.
I think he's being generous and kind because he's made all sorts of lovely, lovely pre-Christmas provisions for we poor parts of the gentler sex, if yes. I might use that word, the to continue to iron with impunity and no effect on climate change. I just think he's a god, a veritable Greek god of a prime minister. And I just wish that I could raise my little polishing cloth a little higher so I could wipe the underside of the glass ceiling and see up to him. God bless him, one and all. What an ass.
Just to put this in context, he said, as many of us know, women are particularly focused on the household budget.
Yeah, of course we are.
And the repeal of the carbon tax means a $550 a year benefit. And he has, as Sue has alluded to, revived memories of another carbon tax comment back in 2010 when, as leader of the opposition as he was then, he said higher electricity prices would impact greatly on women as they did the ironing. And that is outrageous, Steve, because it's men who do the ironing.
Ironing?
Oh, in my house it's men who do the ironing? I'm not allowed near it.
So anyway, can anyone explain to me why a bloke is minister for Sheilas? I mean, this...
Dead man walking now.
I mean, no, seriously. I mean, what? How parochial is this fellow that he has anointed himself as the man who will be responsible for the ladies?
We have a women, Ministry of Women's Affairs minister who's not a feminist. How is it any different?
But she's a female, though, at least. She's more likely to be in tune with the needs of the ladies than Mr. Abbott.
Oh, for God's sake! So you have to have bosoms to know about feminism, do you?
Didn't say about feminism, but I think you're more likely to understand the needs and the struggles of women in society if you are actually a woman who has possibly had the... Hang on,
he's
hang
a very on. Empathetic
why,
man.
Why are we on these sides of this argument? Shouldn't we be on completely opposite sides?
Because it's fun.
I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying watching you.
My head's starting to explode
here. It's like a pair of devil's advocates trying desperately to climb back on the other side of the fence.
Yes.
Someone asks, how old was the pilot who ditched in the Hudson? Sally Sullenberger, how old was he?
Sullenberger, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was described as a mature pilot, and his experience was what saved the lives of all those people.
He was certainly well into his, wasn't he?
He was a silver fox.
Well, there was. I just remember there was a crash back in the US back in the mid 2000s. It was a repositioning flight. There were no passengers on board, but it was a regional airline jet. So it was young pilots. I believe they were in their 20s, and it crashed. It went down from about 41,000 feet. And as far as anyone can figure out at the time, looking at the black box, it was basically two young lads going, "Hey, watch this." And older blokes tend not to do that.
No.
And the old saying in aviation is there are old pilots, there are bold pilots, but there are no old bold pilots.
Pilots, yeah.
John Robert Cocker, OBE, dead of lung cancer at age 70. We should mention this because, I mean, it was such a sad day for boomers, for whom Joe Cocker's famous voice, infused with Sheffield steel, was such an accompaniment to rock music, wasn't it? In the 60s and 1970s.
I've got a friend who's a really big fan of Joe Cocker. He's actually the planning manager at Ashburton District Council. His name is Ian Hyde. And Ian, this is me segueing into a joke, Jim, just so I don't take you by surprise. Ian likes to supply me with dreadful jokes every time I come on the panel that make you cringe. And he said to me today that he went to the zoo the other day, but the only animal that they had on display was a dog.
Sorry, I ruined that ending because Paul was talking in my ear and I didn't hear the punchline.
I'll try it again. Oh, I haven't got there yet.
Oh,
sorry. No, well, that's probably why.
There was a dramatic pause. She was building up to the punchline.
You meant
coming.
No, hang on. Just work with me here. Pretend.
No,
hang on.
Okay.
Pretend. Let me set. We're at the Christmas dinner table. Yes. I've just pulled my cracker. I've put my silly hat on and now I'm unwrapping the Christmas joke and here it comes. I went to the zoo the other day, but the only animal they had was a dog.
Really?
Yes, it was a shih tzu.
I still don't get it.
I'll explain it to you afterwards, Jim.
I wish you would. I thought we were talking about Joe Cocker, but...
Yeah, me too.
We've somehow strayed off into strange realms.
You get by with a little help from your friends.
Oh, dear Lord.
I'm sorry to be so slow. I've got cognitive impairment already, I can tell you.
Anyway, can play a plane, but you can't play a radio station.
We're going to play the thank you. We're going to play the famous high note because I mean this was his biggest hit, R.I.P. Joe. Is this? Hang, here he comes. That was the one. He couldn't always replicate that note live, but he was a memorable performer and a great one. So. We're back with the end-of-year program between 3 and 5, the last panel of the year tomorrow. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Steve McCabe.
Thank you very much.
And you too, Sue Wells.
Thank you very much, Jim. See you tomorrow, Steve.
See ya.
Who will both be on the last panel of the year.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, we all are. And checkpoints following. Thanks, everybody. And we'll leave you with Joe. I'm gonna make time.